That, of course, the Bee Gees' Staying Alive, which gained its fame when used in the movie Saturday Night Fever with John Travolta walking down the street carrying those two paint cans, one of the great iconic moments of the late 70s in movies. That scene was directed by our guest today. His name is John Badham. He's made movies like Saturday Night Fever and War Games and Stakeout and Bingo Long and Point of No Return and Blue Thunder and many, many more. He put together a book called I'll Be in My Trailer about the creative wars between directors and actors. And I think he wrote it as a primer for people who are in the industry, but I read it as a movie fan, and I said, we got to get John on the show to tell some of these stories. So, John, welcome to KMOX.
Well, hi, Paul. I'm glad to be here with you.
How hard was it, by the way, to come up with that particular scene that I referred to there, the paint can swinging and everything else? Was there a Bee Gees song, Staying Alive, when you shot that?
There certainly was. They had pre-recorded. They had a demo of that, and I called them and I said, "Whatever you do with the rest of the song as you finish it, please don't change the tempo, because I'm gonna do a dance to it or walking to it, and we're gonna walk in beat to it. So if you change the tempo, everything will all be messed up."
So you told Travolta you're essentially gonna walk in 4/4 time.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right, and had to learn how to, you know, kind of walk with a little bit of rhythm to it, a little bit of bounce, and so it didn't just look like walking.
Well, it turned into one of the iconic scenes of movie history, as I mentioned, and congratulations on that and many of the other things you did. Let's stay with Saturday Night Fever for a moment, because it's one of the central stories in the beginning of your book here, and the book is, as I mentioned, about the battles that you as a director and others that you interviewed in the book have had with their actors on the set, including one that you had a kind of a face-off with John Travolta about, right?
Well, it just... One of those things that when a young director doesn't quite know how to handle an actor, you get into trouble like this. And there we were staging a scene in the middle of February on the Verrazano Bridge, where it was 30 degrees, you know, just freezing cold, and there was a 30-mile-an-hour wind. And in the middle of the night, 2 a.m, and I bring him out to show him where he's going to stand up on this bridge while they're trying to rescue a young guy who's going to fall off, and he says, I'm not doing that, and I explained to him that he has to do it that way because we shot the stunt people earlier doing it that way, and the stunt people had to do the fall earlier in the night, and he just said, well, I don't care what they did, I'm not doing that, and he goes back to his trailer, and hence the title, I'll Be in My Trailer.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm standing there knowing that we don't have a scene all of a sudden, and we're not coming back tomorrow, and it's getting light in about 3 hours. So I had to, you know, kind of swallow my pride and go in and say, we'll do it your way, and then go into the editing room and see if we can magically jump around this horrible problem that was created. And as I point out in the book, it was really my fault for breaking the number one rule with working with actors, which is never, never stage a scene without them present and participating in it. Otherwise, you're going to have them show up and do exactly what John did. Not his fault. He has his ideas. So at the time, I can tell you, my heart nearly stopped.
Now, it's interesting because at that time, he wasn't what today would be John Travolta in capital letters. He was this guy who had one hit TV series on Welcome Back, Kotter, which was still on the air at the time. He was that big even then to be able to throw his weight around on your set?
No, but he was, and he still is, a very strong-willed person. And he's very kind, and he's very bright, and he knows what's right for him, and he's just good and stubborn, and he could out-stubborn me all day long.
You say in the book, never go to the mat with your cast. Does that mean that even if it's not your fault as a director, you should say it is and do it the actor's way?
That means that going to the mat with your cast is just, it's just fatal. I mean, we're talking about, you know, people who are the leads in your movies, and who you have to work with for the next 8 or 10 weeks. I mean, you have to find ways to negotiate it out with them, because they're really your not your servants, they're your creative partners. And you're dependent on their creativity for the next 8 or 10 weeks. And you could fight them and win that battle today, but Lord help you for the next several weeks.
So if you're going to go to the mat, do it on the last day.
Yes, that's right. That's right, absolutely. And I've had to do a couple of those, too.
And when you've done that and had to kind of accede to the actor's wishes, even if they weren't a huge star at the time, it's probably made things easier. But has it also hurt you with the crew?
You know, often the crew sees what's happening, and they're just sitting there going, "Oh, thank heavens that's not me that's having that argument. Thank heavens that's the director that's doing that."
When I listed your credits here, John, I left out one of my favorites, which is the 1976 movie The Bingo Long, Traveling All-Stars, and Motor Kings, which I just saw again recently on cable. And it's just a wonderful piece of fun movie making. Was it fun to make that? Because I know not every movie is fun to make.
That one was just great, great fun, and it was done under really tough circumstances. We were in Georgia in the middle of July, where it's like 95 degrees and 95% humidity all the time, and everybody was having such a good time that you overcame the misery of the weather. And these, because these baseball players are just phenomenal. They could do things that you never see in the major leagues. And the kind of hitting and fielding and stuff like that, and you put James Earl Jones and Richard Pryor and Billy Dee in the middle of them, you know, and it made this wonderful, delightful history of what was then called Negro baseball.
Mm-hmm. And with a comic side to it as well, because these guys are barnstorming around. They're not allowed to be in the Negro leagues, and so they decide to just barnstorm from town to town and have a tremendous amount of time doing it. But you just mentioned three of the stars of the movie, who are three guys who I'm guessing can be a little bit stubborn themselves. There's that word again.
Well, you'll never find James Earl to be stubborn. He's the most delightful man. But Richard Pryor has his own ideas and was, you know, a very, very creative, funny man with a lot of anger in his system. And the director has to learn, how do you deal with that anger? How do you deal with sometimes things that aren't quite rational and don't quite make sense, and how, you know, get where they're coming from and how to enlist them? But mostly, you know, actors are looking for somebody who they can trust, and you're trying to figure out how to build that trust with them, and they're testing you. And Richard Pryor come in, he'll test you, and he'll make outrageous suggestions and demands, and just see how you respond. You know, he just liked to mess with you.
At one point on that movie, he pretty much said, "That's it, I'm out of here," and threatened to leave, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He said, "He said I'm going home." And since we're in Macon, Georgia, he meant to go home to L.A. And I was at the time a confirmed smart aleck, and looked at him and said, "Well, you know, there's one thing I can tell you about that. Don't go out of the Macon, Georgia airport. Go out of Atlanta. It's a lot easier."
How did that go over with him?
You know what a lead balloon is.
Yeah. What was the incident that led to him wanting to leave town?
He was in a shot that we were doing where we were shooting him driving a car, Billy Dee Williams driving a car, and James Earl Jones driving a motorcycle, and there was this whole parade going through town. And James Earl Jones nearly had a collision with the camera car, and everybody screeched to a halt. And way, way in the back is Richard Pryor driving his car with five team members piled up in it. And we're over attending to James Earl Jones, making sure he's okay and he's not hurt and all of this, and he's fine. And all of a sudden in the background you hear Richard slamming the door of his car and hailing one of the Teamsters driving by in a truck and getting in the truck and going back to the hotel. And then saying, "You tried to kill me. You're out there trying to kill me," and demanding an apology for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "I didn't do anything. I just, you know, we nearly had an accident with James Earl, but you weren't in any danger, and, you know, I don't owe you any kind of an apology. Well, today, many years later, I hopefully am a little smarter, and I would have run over there, even if it wasn't my fault, and say, I'm sorry you're upset, I'm sorry that this frightened you, you know, and that would have done it.
It's News Talk 1120 KMOX, talking with John Badham, movie and TV director. His book is called I'll Be in My Trailer. When you're making a movie, what is more important to you as the director, the people who are going to star in your movie or the words on the page of the script?
Well, you do it because you love the words on the page of the script.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you know that it's not Shakespeare, that it's not perfect. Oftentimes screenplays are just, you know, there's still works in progress. So I think intelligent directors like to take feedback from the actors and see what makes sense. And you try to, you know, then work it out. Now, I like to have the writer on the set with me so he can get in there and kind of battle back and forth so that if an actor wants to change the dialogue, we kind of all work it out together. And I'm a terrible writer, so I know my sense of dialogue is not great. And that's when I'm glad I have the writer.
So you're not a stickler for, here are the words, say them that way, we got to do these things verbatim or we're not going to have the movie we want.
No, because then you're denying your actors their creative ability and saying you're just a slave and a piece of meat here and say the words and shut up.
You started as a director in TV in the late 60s, and lately you've gone back to that medium, and you've been doing episodes of Heroes and Crossing Jordan and Las Vegas and others. What's the difference between being a movie director and a TV director?
It's actually harder to be a TV director in many ways because the schedule is just brutal. And, you know, in a TV show, you do, let's see, in 15 days what you would take 50 days to do in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it wouldn't be exactly the same kind of thing, but, you know, they try to shoot a movie in the average of, say, 10 weeks, and we do a one-hour TV show in 8 days.
I would think part of it would be a little bit easier, though, because the actors, particularly if you're not there on the first couple of episodes, if you come in, say, in the later episodes of the first season or even in later seasons, the actors all know what their characters are and what they're supposed to do, so you as a director don't have to be the one who guides them that way, right?
That's right. They've found their characters, and they know it. They know it pretty well, and you have to listen to them because they're going to know way better how their character works than you do if you're coming in as a guest director.
And does that mean sometimes you have to say to them, you know what, you're right, your character wouldn't do that, we'll change the scene?
Or we have to call the writer over who says, well, no, wait a minute, let's discuss this and let's see, because I wrote this scene. And if you're talking about a really famous writer like David Kelly, he knows those characters as well as the actors. So you have to, again, you have to negotiate. You don't just lay down like a doormat and let them walk over you. You're trying to make the best choice for the movie.
John has directed movies like Stakeout with Emilio Estevez and Richard Dreyfuss, Point of No Return with Bridget Fonda and Gabriel Byrne. He did War Games with Matthew Broderick and A Computer That Spoke.
Shall we play a game?
And John, when you're doing a movie that is going to involve a lot of shots of a computer screen, having the computer speak makes your job easier, doesn't it?
That was one of the big problems with that movie was, how to bring it to life. You know, something that's kind of faceless that doesn't speak, and so we spent a lot of time figuring out how to invent a computer voice. And though that sounds computerized, the voice there, what it was the actor John Wood, who literally read the dialogue backwards. I had him read it backwards. So if the dialogue was "Hello, how are you?" I just have John say, "You are hello, how," and meaning that all the words would be very flat.
Mm-hmm.
Word said individually, and then the sound people had to rearrange the words in the right order, and that gave it a kind of flatness, but it had the inflection of the human being behind it. So it actually, then we tinkered with it and made it all electronified to bring it about.
It's funny that a voice that flat became such a major character on its own.
Mm-hmm. We actually tried. There are a lot of computer programs that will speak and do text, but it just didn't quite work as well as what we did with John Wood.
Did that computer voice ever have a name? I mean, John Wood, the actor, may have been the person behind it, but, you know, in 2001, everybody knew the computer as HAL, which was its name. Was there ever a name for that on the set?
Sure, Joshua.
Joshua, right.
Joshua is the name, which was the little son of the character who invented the computer.
That's right. That's right. I remember now. It's been a while since I've seen it, but another classic. Let's talk a little bit about doing TV again, because you've gone back and forth between the two media so much in your career. Nowadays, there's a lot of concern about advertising and commercials on TV being replaced by product placement on TV shows. Are you encountering that on shows like Heroes or Crossing Jordan or the others that you work on?
They're very aware of when there are products showing up, and if they think that something is not going to be approved, is going to cause them a problem, they're running in there. The prop guys are running in with black tape to put over the names and so on. But you may find that suddenly Lexus drives up on the set,
mm-hmm.
and they've made a deal with Lexus to promote the car. It's interesting that. The newest policy goes back to what it used to be way back in the 60s, where they don't like to show any kind of product placement because later on down the line, if the show goes into syndication on the smaller channels and so on, there might be sponsors who say, I really don't want to see Lexus because I'm Volkswagen, and I don't want us to have Lexuses all over there. So this is kind of a problem, that can be really tricky to devise that. But all the same, things seem to show up miraculously, when people are making some deals, some product placement deals.
Yeah, I can remember seeing TV shows where, Archie Bunker drank a generic brand of beer. Or if you ever saw other brands on TV, you never saw a name brand. The prop guy always, I guess, had to create some sort of generic prop with a generic name to go along with that. Did you direct the shows that had that problem?
Oh, I still do. I still do. It happens all the time. I just did a show called Psych that runs on USA Network,
mm-hmm.
and they had to have a bottle of Russian dressing in there. And a bottle of ketchup, and they went and they made up something, some generic looking labels. They looked like real brands, but they were fake brands. It didn't just say in black letters ketchup. it just looked like some brand other than Heinz.
Yeah, yeah, salad dressing.
Salad dressing. Yes, yeah. And we had Russian dressing, and I literally went to the supermarket and looked around and bought a bottle of Russian dressing and brought it back to the prop man and said, here, make it look something like this, but don't get a suit.
Gotcha. I mentioned a lot of the credits that you did through the years, but there are also movies that you didn't do. And one of my favorite stories, which I'm going to ask you to relate here in our last couple of minutes before I let you go, is about a movie called The Wiz, which ultimately turned out to be directed by Sidney Lumet. But you were supposed to be the original guy behind the camera, right?
Yep. When I was doing research for Bingo Long Traveling All-Stars, I saw The Wiz on Broadway and just fell in love with it. And my partner, Rob Cohen, worked for Motown, and I said, look, why don't we try to get this? And Motown got it, and we were planning to make the movie, as a good, faithful, fun translation of what we had seen on Broadway. And Motown got it in their heads that they wanted Diana Ross to do it, who was easily 20 years too old. She was only 30, but the character really was supposed to be 10 or 12.
Because the character, as played on Broadway, was played by Stephanie Mills, who was, 14, 15, 16 years old at the time. And here's Diana Ross, twice her age.
Twice her age. And things that, in the original Wizard of Oz, the little girl is only 6. And suddenly that makes sense. The Cowardly Lion and the Tin Man and the Scarecrow, all of those things are the things that a child at that age would imagine, not a 30-year-old woman. In a 30-year-old woman, it becomes schizophrenic. And so I said, I can't do this. I don't know how to tell Diana Ross how to behave like this. And so we kind of went back and forth, and finally I said to them, you know what? She's such a wonderful actress and such a wonderful singer and dancer, Diana Ross. Maybe we can do this where we do it from her point of view, and we never see her. We just always see what she sees. And that way she can sing and dance and act, and we just won't realize she's too old.
Mm-hmm.
And that way I managed to get myself fired from the movie.
Yeah, we're going to hire Diana Ross, but we're never going to put her on screen. Good call,
we're
John.
We're never going to see her, yeah. And see, I was trying to get myself fired, because if I just quit, then they didn't have to pay me anything.
Ah.
I'd worked on it for like 8 months for free. And I said, I need something to show for this 8 months. My wife is going to kill me.
I love that story, and I love the other stories that you tell in this book. As I mentioned when we started, you wrote it, I think, to be a primer for people who were movie makers themselves. But as a movie fan, I enjoyed reading it because I love stories about process and inside how you make movies and how you make TV shows. And in that regard, it's a success for movie fans like me as well. Congratulations on that.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so glad you appreciate it, because I was hoping that it would work for a lot of other people other than just film students.
What are you working on next? Are you going to continue doing TV, or are you taking on a feature? What are you doing?
Well, I've got two or three features in the works, and they're all just hard as the devil to get started. So I'm starting on another episode of Vegas on Friday.
Uh-huh.
And, I do that to keep me busy while we try to fight through getting movies started. You know, if it's not Spider-Man 3 or, something else 4, then it's really, really tough.
Yeah.
Maybe I should tell him I want to do Henry the V.
Well, good luck with your future projects. I hope we have a chance to talk more in the future with whatever you're working on. It's been a real pleasure today, John. Thank you.
Paul, great to talk to you. Thank you.
John Badham. The book is called I'll Be In My Trailer, The Creative Wars Between Directors and Actors. You'll find a link to it right now on my website, harrisonline.com. This is News Talk 1120 KMOX.